Parshav Ki Teitse is Malei Mitzvahs Kerimon. It's basically full of mitzvahs. I'm not sure if there's anything in it that's not a mitzvah. I believe it has the highest number of mitzvahs per Parsha in the Torah. And so this evening we will be talking about mitzvahs, selection from the Parsha. And the mitzvah I would like to take a look at the beginning of this year is the mitzvah of Kan Sipur, which we all know a little bit about, and let's see how a certain Meforshim related to this mitzvah. So that's to be found in Perek Kaf Beis, Pasuk Vav, Ki Karei Kan Sipur Lefanecha, should happen upon the nest of the birds, Lefanecha Baderech, Bechol Eit, Ola Aretz, Efrochim Obeitzim. So there's the chicks, or there's the eggs, and the mother is hovering over the chicks or the eggs. Lo tikach e'im alabonim. You can't take them together. You can't take the mother together with the eggs. Rather, shaleach tishalach es ha'im. Send the mother away. Ves habonim tikach lach. And take the young for you, should you so desire. Leman yitav lach. Barachta Yomim, in order that it should be good for you and you should have lengthy days. This is one of those mitzvahs where the Torah, Matan Schorah Betzidoi, promises the reward together at the time of commanding the mitzvah. There is an interesting question we may ask. Perhaps it once happened. Why does a person want the mother bird? The Torah says, you can't take the mother bird. You have to shoot the mother bird away. You can't. Well, presumably he's hungry or for whatever legitimate reason. Sometimes a mitzvah requires that we have a bird. For example, Parshas Metzorah, Zostia Torah Sametzorah. When he becomes a Tohor, so there are birds that are involved. The Shechuta, and then the Shechtuan, and then they send the other away. What if you have a Metzorah? It's an interesting Shaila. He's ready for his Tara, and they need a bird. And the bird that they find is hovering over, it's a mother hovering over the young. Does the mitzvah of purifying the Metzorah make it permissible or acceptable to take the bird under these circumstances? Or do we say no? You can never take regardless of circumstance. This question is actually the subject of the final Mishnah in Maseches Chulin. There in Kuf Mem Beis Amud Aleph, we've kind of cut to the chase. Lo yital adam eim albonim. It is forbidden to take the mother, either the mother by herself or together with the young. Afilu letahiras hametzorah, even for the noble and Torah mandated purpose of purifying the metzorah, you've got to get a bird from somewhere else. Okay, now we know. Then the Mishnah continues with words of machshava. It seems, uma im mitzvah kala, and if already an easy mitzvah. Omra Torah leman yitavlach barachta yomim. The Mishnah is now devoting its attention, or directing its attention, to the fact that the Torah has promised reward for this mitzvah. Says the Mishnah, shiluach haken is not really that hard to do. You could classify it as an easy mitzvah. And if already with an easy mitzvah the Torah promises such reward, kal vachomer al mitzvos chamuros sheba Torah. How much more so the more stringent mitzvahs in the Torah will have ample reward. Those are the words of the Mishnah. And one of the Meforshim raised the question, are these two parts of the Mishnah connected? The first part is a halachic discussion. Could you take the mother bird for purposes of a mitzvah? And the answer is no. Then the Mishnah immediately shifts theme, it seems, that begins to talk about the fact that there's such reward for the mitzvah. Is that in any way connected to the halachic ruling at the beginning of the Mishnah, that you can't take it for a mitzvah? Doesn't seem to be. But this matter was discussed in a most outstanding way by one of the great early Acharonim, the Bechor Shor. The Bechor Shor, Rav Alexander Sender Shor, one of the classics. And he will take us on a bit of a pilpul excursion, which will be brief. And he raises the question, why do we call Kan Sipur an easy mitzvah? I mean, we call it a mitzvah kala, a light mitzvah, an easy mitzvah. To call a mitzvah a light mitzvah is not something that should be said lightly. After all mitzvahs are important, all mitzvahs are... But the Mishnah calls it a mitzvah kala. Says the Bechor Shor, the reason why it's a mitzvah kala is because it's easy to do. Why do we say it's easy to do? By definition, Kan Sipur is easy to do. There's an interesting question that some ask. How much does a person need to put himself out to fulfill the mitzvah of Kan Sipur? What if there's none in your vicinity? Do you need to travel? Do you need to take an excursion? And interestingly, the answer is not only do you not have to travel and make it your business to come upon the Kan Sipur, the mitzvah only applies when you happen upon it. And that is based on the opening words of this mitzvah, which state, Ki yikarei Kan Sipur, says the Gemara, b'me'ura lefanecha, it just happens when you happen upon the Kan Sipur. Interestingly, the word yikarei here is written with an aleph, not with a hey. Normally, yikarei with a hey, we would say is mikre, you happen upon it. Nonetheless, the Gemara darshans that yikarei, specifically if you chance upon it, so to speak. But you can't go looking for it by definition. So now we understand full well why we refer to Kan Sipur as an easy mitzvah. You don't have to put yourself out for it. The mitzvah only happens when you didn't really try and do it at all. And it's just there. And they just shoo away the mother. Nothing could be simpler. Now, should we ask, well, would there be perhaps reason from these verses to think that you should have to go out of your way to perform this mitzvah? Says the Bechor Shor, yes, because there's a conflicting sounding message. The Pasuk Zion says, Shaleach Teshalach Es Ha'eim. Now that double expression, Shaleach Teshalach, which we always have to be very wary of. The tendency is to translate these expressions as surely. You put the word surely in and hope for the best. But the Torah is, of course, sure about everything, even though it didn't double over. When the Torah says, Lo tirtzach, do not murder, it's quite sure about that, even though it didn't say, Ratzoach lo tirtzach. And therefore, Shaleach tishalach, it can't just be adding to be sure. Rather, under most cases, when we have this double expression, the halachic verdict is, Mikol makom. Under any circumstances, in any way possible. And therefore we're beginning to see a bit of a tension between two ports in the verses here. On the one hand, ki karei sounds like, could sound like, if you happen upon it, then it's a mitzvah. Shaleach tishalach means do whatever it takes in order to fulfill this mitzvah. So which one wins out, and what about the other one? So as we've seen, ki karei sets the tone here. It's only if you happen upon it. Should we ask, well, what about the double expression, Shaleach Teshalach? Doesn't that sound like in any way possible? Do whatever it takes. Actually, that expression, Shaleach Teshalach, is used for a different halacha. We raised the question before, does it make a difference why you'd like to take the mother bird? If it's only for your purposes, what if it's for a mitzvah? The halacha is, even if it's for a mitzvah, Lo tikach ha'eim al habonim. How do we know that? How do we know that even if it's for a mitzvah, you can't take the mother? Says the Gemara there in Chulin. That is what we learn from the two expressions, Shaleach to Shalach. Says the Gemara, two possibilities, two scenarios. Number one, Shaleach l'devar harishus, for your own purposes, and to Shalach l'devar mitzvah. Even for a mitzvah, like the classic example of purifying the mitzvah. Says the Bechor Shor, all of our groundwork has now been done. Now we are able to understand the flow of the Mishnah. The Mishnah began by telling us the halachic ruling. You can't take the mother, even if it's for purposes of a mitzvah. And then went on to talk about the even kansipor, it's so easy, kal v'chomer for a difficult mitzvah. How are those two things connected? It says b'chor shor, because the source of the first ruling is what allows for the continuation of the Mishnah. The first ruling says even for a mitzvah you can't take. What's the source for that ruling? The double expression of shaleach to shalach. Were it not for that ruling, shaleach to shalach would have given us to understand you have to do whatever it takes in order to fulfill this mitzvah. But once the two expressions shaleach to shalach are for the two scenarios of reshus and mitzvah, now the words ki yikarei are able to emerge and set the tone for how much you need to do for this mitzvah, only if you happen upon it. And once that is possible, we're able to classify this mitzvah as a mitzvah kala, because it's so easy, you don't have to do anything. It's only if you happen upon it, which is how the Mishnah continues, that if Kansipor is a mitzvah kala, and the Torah writes that reward, we know that it's a mitzvah kala because of the discussion. Shaleach to shalach leaves ki yikarei to identify it as a mitzvah kala, kal v'chomer for mitzvah chamura. So this is a glimpse of how the greats would learn a Mishnah. In fact, the very question is noteworthy for us. The Mishnah says two things, one after the other. Are they connected? Are they sequential? Are they causal? And the answer, if you know how to demonstrate it, is absolutely yes. Now, there is another angle with regards to Kansipur that referred to it as a mitzvah kala. And in fact, the Medrash elsewhere contrasts Kansipur with a mitzvah that it calls mitzvah chamura, a difficult mitzvah, and that is the mitzvah of kibud av va'em. And interestingly, both of these are examples of mitzvahs where the Torah has written reward next to the mitzvah. We just read Kansipur, leman yitavlach, barach dayamim, kibud av va'em, of course, leman yarichon yamecha, and the Medrash actually links the two. Sending the mother bird away is mitzvah kala, kibud av va'em is mitzvah chamura, and they both have the reward next to that. The question is, why with reference to kibud av va'em, or contrasted with honoring parents, would we look upon shiluach haken as a mitzvah kala? We've already seen that it's not that hard to do, but there's something else. From the times of Chazal themselves, we've seen a lot of discussion as to what's the reason, if we may say, behind the mitzvah or accompanying the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. Some Rishonim say that it's in order to develop Rachmanus, after all, to have a consideration for the feelings of the mother, that she should see her young, send her away, even though it's not going to be that pleasant a few moments later when she comes back, but nonetheless, one can't hang around forever, at least some type of gesture of compassion. Now, the truth is that the Mishnah in Maseches Brachos seems to indicate that one shouldn't ascribe such a reason for the mitzvah of Kansipur. The famous Mishnah there in Brachos in the fifth perek, there's a short list of things that if a person says them, we tell him to be quiet. There's actually three things on that list. That list has grown since the time of the Mishnah for halachic and artistic reasons, but the original list only has three things, that you silence the person. They are, if he says, as in the course of a tefillah, Al Kansipur Yagir Rachamecha, you had Rachmanus on the mother bird, have Rachmanus on us. That sounds wonderful. And if he says another couple of things, Al Tov Yizachimecha, your name should be mentioned for good. Modim, if he says modim twice for all these three things, we tell him to be quiet. And what these things have in common is that he means well. In all of them, he thinks he's making things better. He doesn't realize he's opening things up to be worse. Says the Mishnah, says the Gemara in explanation. For example, he says, Ala tov yuzach hashemecha, may your name be mentioned over good. That's a potentially very problematic thing to say, because what if something bad happens? Whose name should be mentioned over that? He hasn't thought it through. He thinks he's helping, but he may be causing trouble. Modim. Certainly in the times of the Mishnah, also in the Gemara, the Zoroastrian dualism was very problematic. He says modem and says modem again. So who does it sound like the second modem is talking to? He thinks he's making things better. He may be making things worse. And what about Alkansi Por Yagirach Amecha? What has this poor gentleman done? All he did, he tried to offer a tefillah. It sounds very nice. You had Rachmanos on the mother bird, have Rachmanos on us. So the words of the Gemara, Mipnei She'osa Midosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rachamim, because he has tried to portray the mitzvahs as acts of mercy, the Einam Ela Gezeros, but they are nothing other than divine decrees. He's misrepresenting the mitzvah, and again, he means it in a good way. It's a very heartwarming prayer, but that's, he's presenting or precipitating a misunderstanding. That's not what mitzvahs are all about. But then the question is, well, if the Gemara itself objects to saying that the mitzvah of Kansipur is out of compassion for the mother bird, how can Rishonim then proceed to say that? The Rambam says it in the Mor Nevuchim, the Ramban says it in his commentary on this week's Parsha, and he's well aware that the Mishnah says that, that sounds objectionable. Says Ramban, there's a major distinction between what the Mishnah says is objectionable and what we're talking about. What the Mishnah says is objectionable is to imply that the beneficiary of the mitzvah of Kansipur is the mother bird. That's a problem. Because then the implication is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want the mother bird to have too difficult a time, and therefore between Hashem and us, we kind of see to it that the mother bird that doesn't have too much of an unpleasant experience. Says Ramban, that person has missed the point. Because the focus of the mitzvah of Kansipur is not the mother bird. It's the Jewish people. In other words, you need to develop within yourself compassion. The way the Torah says to do that is by sending away the mother bird. But don't think that the one who gains out of this exercise is none other than the mother bird. She's fine. You need work. And therefore, says Ramban, quoting the Gemara elsewhere, Lo nitnu mitzvos ele letzarif lehem es habrios. The mitzvahs are given to develop people. That's a major distinction. What the Mishnah objects to is thinking that the whole end, the be all and end all of the mitzvah of Kansipur is to see to it that the mother bird is okay. No, it's to see that you develop as people. Now, this discussion continues. So far, we've seen the Gemara, Rishonim, but it continues in the writings of Rav Ehrentreu Zatzal, the Av Beis Din of Munich, the grandfather of the Av Beis Din of London now, Rav Chanoch Ehrentreu, in his Drushas Kometz HaMincha. And he notes that although this explanation, we understand it in a general way, there's a particular halacha which it will not explain. And that is, and the Gemara darshans, that what if the nest where the bird and the young are, what if it's in your own property? What if it's on your merpeset, something like that? The halacha is, there's no mitzvah to send away the mother bird. Interesting. In the words of the Gemara, it comes from, again, from the words ki yikare. Ki yikare means you happen upon it. Prat lemezuman, excluding where it's in your, literally in your own backyard. Now, if we go with a general approach, that Kansipur is about having Rachmanos on the mother bird, what difference does it make if she lives with you? I mean, on the contrary, she's already a Hamish with you. You should also certainly have compassion, certainly no less. So if we may ask, how could we account for this anomaly within Kansipur that it doesn't apply if the bird is actually lives on your premises? You could actually take that bird. The Kometz HaMincha has a wonderful approach to this mitzvah. It's mutter for the fact is it's mutter for human beings to use animals for legitimate purposes. That's a fact. It's also true, on the other hand, and in the terms of the ecological balance, that the living beings that we are entitled to use, they're entitled to object to being used. I mean, they have mechanisms, and they have instincts, and they have the capacity to evade to the extent that they can, and that becomes the balance. They don't have to submit. Now, with that in mind, It's fair, so to speak, to use a living animal for legitimate purposes under general circumstances. The animal could run away. And in this instance, it wasn't able to run away. But this gives us now a whole new perspective on the mother bird. When the young are there, the mother stays. And that is the maternal instinct of the bird overriding the self-preservation instinct of the bird. And under those circumstances, it is unacceptable to take the bird because it's not fair. As if to say, in the normal give and take of how these things go, the bird, you win a few, you lose a few, ran away, and this time it couldn't get away, and that's okay. But here, the bird would have got flown away. It's caring for its young keeps it by the nest. If you take it, you've done something very wrong, because you have exploited or taken advantage of the maternal instinct of the bird. You've used it to trap the bird. And that is a mercenary act. That is a cruel act. Fascinating explanation. And moreover, says the Kometz HaMincha, with this in mind, we understand that exceptional halacha, that if the bird is on your premises anyway, there's no mitzvah to send away the mother bird. Because under these circumstances, we don't say that were not for the young, the bird would have got away. The bird lives with you, and therefore you would have been able to chap it even without the young being there. That's not considered to be taking advantage of the bird as a mother, and therefore it's permissible. It's a whole new insight to this mitzvah. And it doesn't stop there, because if we say that the goal of the mitzvah is to develop something within us, what is it that we're looking to develop with the mitzvah of Kan Sipur? If within the bird, it's in order to appreciate and respect and give full sensitivity to what the mother bird is prepared to do for its young, the end result must be for us to appreciate what our parents do for us. If the bird is in a sense the exercise through which, be sensitive to what a mother is prepared to do for a child, and appreciate that, and don't take advantage of it. So then the moral of the story is, no, and with our own parents, your own mother, appreciate that. That's Letzarif Behemes Habrios. And now we understand very well why the two mitzvahs of Kan Sipur and Kibud Av V'Em are always linked together. Because Kan Sipur is actually a vehicle to fulfilling the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. See, Kibud Av V'Em is a difficult mitzvah. It's a mitzvah chamura. Why is respecting the mother bird easier than respecting your own mother? Because the mother bird is not your mother. And it's always possible to respect someone else's mother, and especially if it's just a bird. In a sense, it's such a pure situation, everyone can relate to it, and that's why it's a perfect training ground for the actual mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. That is why things that are detached from us are ironically easier for us to relate to and to connect with, because they don't threaten us. If you send away the mother bird and you're considerate to her, it doesn't mean you then have to call her every week, unlike your own mother. And therefore, we find, for example, the concept of a mashal, which is used even in Tanakh, whereby the mashal isn't real. It's not about you, which allows you to identify with it 100%. And once you've done that, then it becomes about you. You're the nimshal. Even Nasan Hanavi, when he gave a rebuke to David HaMelech for the Maisa with Bathsheba, he began with the famous mashal, the rich man and the poor man, and he stole from the poor man, and David was enraged, and rightly so. At that point, Nasan said, "You're the rich man," and David got the point. And for Kan Sipur and Kibud Av V'Em are linked, because Kan Sipur leads to Kibud Av V'Em. Easy to respect the mother bird. But one's own mother, I mean, if one is Jewish, one's mother is a Jewish mother. And that's a whole genre of literature right there. And therefore the Torah helps us with the mitzvah of Kansipur. Wonderful, wonderful interpretation of the Kohmetz HaMincha. Okay. So from Kansipur, let us move further in the Parsha to Perek Kafdalet Pasuk Yud Zayin. Many, many halachas and mitzvahs. Perek Kafdalet Pasuk Yud Zayin. Lo Sate Mishpat Ger Yaso. Do not pervert the case of Ger Yosom. We've mentioned in the past, according to the Balaturim, this is the source for the halachic maxim that when one converts to Judaism, they're considered to have been born on that day. Ger Shinesgar Kukot and Shanola Dami, all their prior family connections have been detached. And the Balaturim says the source for that are these words, Lo Sate Mishpat Ger Yosom. Ger and Yosom are two different people. Ger is a convert and Yosom is an orphan. He has no parents. But it doesn't say Vav Ger V'Yosom, indicating, says Balaturim, every Ger is a Yosom, because as soon as he converts, he has no family connections anymore. V'lo tachbol beged almana. Do not take the clothing of a woman as chavola, as security, as a pledge. Pledge, if one lends money, one is entitled to take a pledge. Something of security, collateral. However, if she's an almana, it's also. Okay. Now, we should know there is a major dispute amongst the Tanoim. It's recorded in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, with regards to the parameters of this mitzvah, this prohibition. Lo tachbol beged almana. Again, succinctly stated, you cannot take the clothes of an almana, of a widow, as collateral. What type of widow? Pasuk doesn't say. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the first opinion, any. Doesn't make a difference. Is she of means? Is she of not of means? Doesn't matter. Bein aniya, bein ashira, the Torah says. Torah said. Along comes Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. And Rabbi Shimon rules that if she's poor, then you can't take collateral. But if she's rich, you can. Now, why? Rav Shimon needs to explain himself. And he does. The Gemara in Bar Mitzvah, Daf Kuf Tes Vav, Amud Aleph, says the Gemara, Rav Shimon reasons as follows. The Torah says you can't take the clothes of an almana, a widow, as collateral. Why not? Because, says Rabbi Shimon, there's another halacha, and that is when someone needs their collateral back, you have to give it back to them. Ad bo ha-shemesh, tishivenu lo. Whenever they need it, you have to give it back. Which means the classic scenario is, if you take, back in the day, people had very few possessions. During the day, their night clothes are available. During the night, their day clothes are available. Which means if you will actually be visiting the person that you have lent money to regularly. In the day, so you give him back his day clothes and take his night as collateral. In the night, give him back his night clothes, take his day as a collateral. Says Rabbi Shimon, you can't do that with a widow. Nimsa masia shem ra b'shcheinu seha. You will sully her name. You will ruin her reputation. If she has what they call in the classics, a gentleman caller, morning and evening, returning her nightgown and her clothes, the whole neighborhood will be abuzz. And therefore, says the Torah, forget about it. Leave it out. Lo tachbol beged almana. That's quite a thing to say. Now, essentially, we have arrived at what is known in the Gemara as the question of darshinan tama dekra. Do we expound reasons for mitzvahs in a way that could affect the halacha? And that is identified as a dispute. That's the matter under dispute between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, the Torah says, she's a widow, out of bounds. What type? Of means, not of means? Doesn't matter. Torah didn't say, I don't know. So the whole thing is out of bounds. And Rabbi Shimon enters the fray And he says, well, if you consider the reason, and here, of course, parenthetically, you've got to be Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai to say the reason, so then you will understand that it applies to certain circumstances, and the halacha could be affected by that. Now, le halacha, we rule like Rabbi Yehuda, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, no question about that. That lo darshinan tam adekra. We do not expound reasons for mitzvahs of our own understanding, which could then affect the halacha one way or the other. Okay, that's the halacha. However, we will see, and I think what I've said so far in this matter is somewhat known, but we will see that the matter is not so clear-cut. It's somewhat more nuanced in the following way. We will see that under certain circumstances, even we, meaning Rabbi Yehuda's camp, the halacha, will expound the reasons for things that the Torah said in a way that will have halachic implications. And if that's true, we will need to crystallize our understanding of where we part ways with Rabbi Shimon. And let me give you an example. The Torah disqualifies a rasha, however that's defined, and it is defined, a rasha, someone who's wicked, a willful sinner, it disqualifies him from being a witness in a din Torah. Okay, pasuk says, "Atashes yotcha imrasha leos eid chamas." Right, you cannot join together. You cannot be part of a legal proceeding. Okay, why? Torah didn't say. So what do we have so far? If he's a rasha, he's out. Anything else? We have no idea. But in the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, Rava states that anyone that you have reason to think that he may lie out of greed, if he's suspect in any way, he's not a rasha, but you have reason to think, ample reason to suspect that he himself is suspect to lie for greed, also possible. What's his source? Says Rava, my source is the Torah. The Torah says a rasha is disqualified to be a witness. And why is a rasha disqualified to be a witness? Well, the Torah didn't say, but Rava's talking now. Because if he's a rasha, you suspect that maybe he'll lie for no good reasons. If that's true, then anyone who you may suspect would lie for no good reasons, even if he's not a rasha, but there is that grounds for that suspicion, will equally and likewise be disqualified. That sounds a lot like Tama Dekra. I mean, we have basically now, the halacha has had been impacted by the reason that was presented by Rava for something that the Torah did not give us the reason for. Very similarly, the Torah states that family members cannot bear witness one over the other. It's actually based in this week's parsha. Lo yumsu avos al bonim, the Gemara Darshans means, fathers shouldn't die on the count of children, aside from the simple meaning on because of their sins, and they shouldn't die based on the testimony of their children. That's the source for disqualifying family members. Says the Gemara, again in Sanhedrin, Daf Kaf Ches, whenever you feel that the relationship between the witness and the one he is giving testimony about is too unbalanced. For example, they're best friends. They're the best of friends. Disqualified. Ohev is disqualified. By the same token, if they're enemies, they're disqualified. What's the source? Says the Gemara, the source is the Torah's disqualification of family members. Why are family members disqualified from giving testimony? Because family have a very special connection. And therefore anyone else who has a special connection, and therefore by contrast a special disconnection, will equally and likewise be disqualified. Once again, that sounds a lot like Tama Dekra. The Torah never spoke about good friends, best friends. The Torah never spoke about enemies. But the halacha does, and it comes, it's based on an analysis of the reason for the mitzvah of the Torah. What are we to make of this? Last we checked, we don't subscribe to this approach of propounding reasons for mitzvahs, which will then have halachic implications. So the classic explanation the matter is found in the Sefer Aruch Laner. Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, in his parish Aruch Laner, Nasecha Sanhedrin. In its source, it's the Mishnah Lamelech and Hilchus Psulei Mizbeach, but we don't need to go there. The Aruch Laner says the following major distinction or qualification. Even we, who officially do not propound reasons for mitzvahs, we will, when the result will be to extend the reason that we see within the mitzvah, again, we as the Chazal, we see within the mitzvah, to other cases that the Torah may not have spoken about. We will use the reason for the mitzvah as a platform to broaden the scope of what the halacha might be. Where do we find the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon? When ascribing a reason for the mitzvah cuts in and curtails what it is that the Torah said. In other words, the Torah stated, Lo tachbol beged almana. She's a widow, you can't take collateral. Under what circumstances? Didn't say. Sounds like ever. Any type of almana. And that's Rabbi Yehuda's approach. Along comes Rabbi Shimon and says, no, what type of situation is the Torah talking about? What type of amana? If she is not of means, because of the reason that he said. But if she is of means, then she's an amana, and Rabbi Shimon says it's mutter. There we draw the line. The Torah did not distinguish between different types. You can't use the reason to eat into the scope of what the Torah seems to be saying. But to broaden it beyond what the Torah is talking about, that's a surprise. Even we do that. And therefore, for example, the Torah says you cannot include a Rosha as a witness in a Beis Din. Ever. The reason is, we perceive the reason, is because he's suspect of lying for personal gain. Okay, we take that and we extend it. Anyone now who is suspect of lying for personal gain, even if he's not a Rasha, that doesn't cut into what the Torah is talking about because this person isn't a Rasha. We've extended. And we should know, by the way, that Gemara says in Masechah Shavuos, when a Rasha is disqualified from being a witness, that's even if you know that he's telling the truth. How would you know he's telling the truth? What if the head of the Beis Din who's hearing his testimony was there at the time? Now he's disqualified because he's the Dayan. But he knows for a fact that every word this Rasha is saying is true. We should take a picture because the Rasha is telling the truth. But he knows that it's true. It doesn't matter. He still can't accept his testimony. Why? Because the Torah says you can't accept testimony from a Rasha. That's us. That's a classic example. Exactly the same thing is true with regards to family members. The Torah says, Lo yumsu avos habonim. Family members are disqualified from testifying one for the other. Why? The Gemara gives a reason. Because they have a special connection with each other, they may bend the truth or distort the facts for each other. If that's the reason, so then that can apply to non-family members who have that type of connection. Best of friends or worst of enemies, that's all true. Because it extends outside of what the Torah is saying. But once again, we should be aware that within what the Torah is saying, family members can never give testimony for each other. They're never qualified. Classic example, even Moshe and Aaron, the two people who are above and beyond reproach, but they're brothers. And they could not give testimony one for the other because the Torah says family can't give testimony one for the other. I think with this in mind, we can understand just as a concluding comment for this very major statement about the halacha, this may help us understand one approach to an interesting position of the Rosh with regards to the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. The mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah is mitzvah number Taryag, V'atar kispu lachem asashira hazos, is darshan as writing a Sefer Torah. And the Rosh in the very beginning of Hilchos Sefer Torah says, and a startling thing, in our time, says Rosh, people don't use a Sefer Torah the way they used to. It used to be that the only thing you could write down was a Sefer Torah, which means your learning material was a Sefer Torah. Everyone had one, and they used them regularly. Nowadays, says Rosh, and this is how he describes it, no one learns from a Sefer Torah. If you're fortunate enough to have a Sefer Torah, you keep it locked up in shul. And if anyone should try and remove it from the Oren for purposes of learning from it, they will call synagogue security and have him removed because he did a terrible thing. He took a Sefer Torah out of the Oren. It's meant to be taken out of the Oren, says the Rush, but not anymore. What do we do in our times? Mishnayos, Gemara, and other Chumashim, not in a Sefer Torah type of way. They are what are written down, and they are what we learn from. And therefore, says the Rosh, in our time, the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah is fulfilled through writing all of those things that we learn from. Mishnayos, Gemara, Chumashim, because that's what the mitzvah is all about. Now, opinion is divided amongst the Poskim as to whether the Rosh means to say that those other books now take the place of writing a Sefer Torah. It's a very radical thing to say. Some say it. The Prisha says that. But according to the Beis Yosef, the Rosh is maintaining this in addition, as if to say the mitzvah, of course, Sefer Torah. But don't stop there, because what's it all about? It's about learning, and people don't learn from a Sefer Torah now. So write other things that people do learn from, in addition to, not in substitution of. But nonetheless, as the Chasam Sofer raises the question, this sounds like Tama Dekra. Given the reason that you ascribe to the mitzvah, so that will result in a broadening of the mitzvah, other things, the Torah didn't speak about other things. So how can you, based on this reason? We've mentioned in the past, with regards to the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah, it's possible to perceive that the Torah itself gave the reason for the mitzvah. For when it says Kisvu lachem es hashira hazos, it goes on to say Velamdo es Yisrael, and use it to teach the Jewish people, and therefore it's possible to perceive that the Torah itself is given the reason, which may change everything. However, based on our discussion, we can understand the Beis Yosef's position that we're not looking to substitute the original mitzvah, but ascribing a reason will broaden the mitzvah. That's something that we have seen the Gemara does, and that's what the Rosh seems to be doing, broadening the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah from the Sefer Torah itself to all those other works that we learn from. Let us take a look in the final section of the Shiur at the final part of Parshas Ki Teitze, the mitzvah of Mechias Zecher Amalek. Famous as Zochor, it's maftir for Parshas Ki Teitze. And at the very end, the Torah says, remember what Amalek did. And the final words are, Timche Zecher Amalek. You've got to destroy the remembrance of Amalek. What does that mean? Rashi comments from the Medrash. Apparently it needs comment. It means everyone. All people, if you can find Amalek, Mishor Va'atseh, all of their animals. What's their animals got to do with are they Amaleki animals? Shelo Yehishem Amalek Nizkar Afilu Ala Behema. There shouldn't be anything left that Amalek's name will be mentioned regarding that item. As if to say, Loma Behemazu Mishel Amalek Haisa. Oh, that was an Amalek's animal. That's already for the people that are still remembering Amalek. Tim Chasecha Amalek means no item that people will have an association with Amalek anymore. It's an interesting question. Could you take their animals and mix them in with all the other animals and then no one can tell anymore? That's a shaila that actually the Poskim deal with. But from a Parshanut point of view, we should note that a very similar formula with regards to Amalek has already been mentioned in the Torah. At the time of the original battle, in the end of Parshas Bishalach, the laning for Purim morning, so there Hashem says, "Ksov sov sikaron b'sefer b'sim b'sneim Yeshua, ki macho emche es zecher Amalek. I'll destroy zecher Amalek, the remembrance of Amalek." Now, interestingly, there should we wonder, what does Zecher Amalek mean? It's a similar question. Rashi makes no comment. If you look at where Rashi should be in the end of Parshas Bishalach, he lets it go without comment. And that is very unusual because normally Rashi will comment on the first available opportunity for comment in the Torah. Zecher Amalek has already featured in the Torah. Rashi didn't say anything. And at the end of Ki Teitze, we've almost finished. The end of Kiteitse, Timche Secher HaMalek, Rashi says, you know what Secher HaMalek means, and why does he only tell it to us the second time round? And this question is addressed by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zatzal, in his Biurim on Rashi, and he says a couple of things. Firstly, there is a difference syntactically or contextually between these two situations. Originally, Hashem says, Macho Emche Secher HaMalek. I will destroy the remembrance of Amalek. What does that mean? Who knows what it means? I mean, maybe it means exactly what it sounds like it means. Hashem is capable of doing anything, and Zecher sounds like the very memory of, if Hashem says he'll wipe out the memory of Amalek, so that apparently that's what will happen. It becomes more difficult in our parsha when it becomes a mitzvah. Timche es Zecher Amalek. And the reason why is because you can't command a person not to remember something, because the only way they can fulfill the mitzvah is by remembering it. And therefore, as soon as they say, Hinini Muchan Mazuman Lakai Mitzvah Timcha Secher Amalek, they're out, because they just mentioned Amalek and they remembered him again. And that's why, within the context of a mitzvah, Rashi sees fit to say that people may either remember or forget. You can't say it's not about the memory, but you can tell them to destroy items that have associations with Amalek, and that's why Rashi commented here. The Torah itself, additionally, concludes with the words Lo Tkaf, don't forget. You can't not forget if you don't remember, and therefore it's of the essence here for Rashi to give us some more guidance as to what exactly Zecher HaMalek means. We should note, maybe with this we'll conclude, that these words, or Mitzimche Zecher HaMalek, are the source of a well-known minhag for us, even though it underwent something of a change, one could say. As we know, when we read the Megillah, and we say the name Haman, people make noise. I mean, that's, if there's any minhag that exists in every single shul, unless it's been itself stamped out, that's the minhag of making noise when they say Haman. Now, the source of this minhag is in Rishonim. And that's what the Rama says. One should be very slow to be critical of any minhag that you see. Sometimes it can get out of hand. But the minhag itself is to be found in one of the Rishonim, the Sefer Orchos Chaim, which is quoted in the Beis Yosef in Hilchos Megillah. And what the Orchos Chaim used to do was as follows. He used to write the name Haman on a piece of wood, and when they say Haman, he would bang the piece of wood against a wall or the floor. Why? In order to erase the name of Haman from where he'd written it, in fulfillment of the pasuk Timche es Zecher HaMalek. And his source was a medrash. For the medrash commenting on the words Timche es Zecher HaMalek says, Afilu me'al ha'etzim u'me'al ha'avonim. Wipe out the name of Amalek even from on top of wood surface, even from a stone surface. And that's what he would do. He would take a block of wood and write, and then erase the name of Amalek, min ha'etzim u'min ha'avonim, me'al ha'etzim u'min ha'avonim. That's the original minhag, as it's recorded. Interestingly, our minhag has taken the audio aspect of that original minhag, but not so much the video aspect of it. We no longer write. The banging is to produce sound, not to erase script. That's changed a little bit. When it comes nearer to Purim, there are potentially halachic considerations with regards to making so much noise. As true as it is that there's a mitzvah to erase the name of Amalek, there is also a mitzvah to hear every single word of the Megillah. And therefore you arrive at some type of tension, whereby he's Haman, but if they start making noise before he's finished saying Haman, so then people aren't yet to the Megillah. So then he says Haman again, which is undesirable for Haman to come back again. But you have no choice, because it's more important to hear the Megillah. You can erase the name of Amalek another time. We should note, however, that there is one source in the Rishonim which seems to refer to the minhag of making noise per se. And that is the Sefer Shibale Haleket, again one of the Rishonim, and it's actually said in the name of Rashi, that the minhag in his shul is that they would bring in earthenware pots, and when the name Haman was mentioned, they would smash the pots. I have not seen that replicated, even those who have a very strong sense of Masorah in other shuls. People are relatively a lighter version of that. Interestingly, also Inyan, and I'm not sure people normally think of this, why do we say, why do we make noise when Haman's name is mentioned? Because, I mean, Haman is from Amalek. The way the minhag is recorded in the Orchos Chaim, and again, he used to write Haman's name. He didn't just write Haman's name. He wrote Haman's name and all of his sons. Because if there's one thing we can be sure about Haman's sons, is if he's from Amalek, then they're from Amalek. And the mitzvah to wipe out the memory of Amalek is as applicable to his sons as it is to him. He's not more meyuchas than them. And here we see that as script moved to sound, it becomes somewhat unwieldy. There is no way that you can start clapping when making noise when all of the names of Haman's sons are mentioned. Remember, the Balkari has got to say it all in one breath. So if he starts on Parshandatar and then they start making noise and then Dalfono, he'll never get to the end of it. But that's very interesting that the names were written, all of them, that's 11 people. A further interest, I might mention, I haven't seen anyone, even the women's groups, who've lobbied for making noise when Zeresh's name is mentioned in terms of equal rights to be erased. But it seems to devolve only to Haman himself. Maybe she wasn't from Amalek. A very interesting minhag, which is many of the Rebbes did this, and it begins with the Rebbe of Heschel, who wasn't a Rebbe in that sense. He came before all of that. But the Rebbe of Heschel of Krakow, it's recorded that when he used to fashion a new quill, and they would always try it out, just to try it for does it write well and smoothly? So the first thing you write isn't really something you mean to write, because you're not sure how the quill would turn out. His minhag was he would break in a new quill by writing the word Amalek and then erasing it, and that would smooth out the quill to fulfill, even in such a small thing, the mitzvah of Mechias Zecher Amalek. The final point of interest with regards to this this idea of Timcheh Zecher Amalek is based in the Gemara in Bava Basra, in Perchezkas Habatim, deep into the halachas there, on Daf Mem Vav. And there, the Gemara is discussing halachas as they apply to monetary laws and certain situations. There's different monetary designations. There's an Orev, who's a guarantor, and then there's a Malve, who's a lender, and then there's a Lokeach, a purchaser, and a Kabla, and a contractor. And the Gemara has a question, and it raises the Shaila as to how it applied to each of them. Now, we know that it's the way of the Gemara to facilitate memory, that it will always give a siman. If there's like a string of cases, it will give you a siman, just yalkagam, just to make it easier, a mnemonic. Well, the four cases that the Mishnah, that the Gemara discusses are Orev, Malveh, Lokeach, and Kablan. And the siman that the Gemara gives is Amalek, because that's Ayin, Mem, Lamed, and Kuf, Amalek siman. And this caught the attention of Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his notes to the Gemara there. And he wrote on the side, in his margin, he says, I'm somewhat surprised. After all, the Torah says, Timcheh Zecher Amalek, you're meant to eradicate them, the memory of Amalek, and it became a siman in the Gemara, Amalek siman. But then Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, no, but on the contrary, I came to understand and appreciate that the greatest way to fulfill the mitzvah of blotting out the memory of Amalek is to take the very word and to use it in the furtherance of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. That is the ultimate fulfillment of Timcheh Zecher Amalek. So we've seen there's a number of variations on this mitzvah with regards to Bechias Amalek. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Pick up next week.